future drive to get action pre-Easter. That warning, that a civil rights bill could pass only if it reached the Senate floor by the Easter recess, had of course first been made months before. Now, on April 12th, the Easter recess arrived. The bill was not on the floor. It was nowhere near the floor. Furthermore, should it ever get there, other urgent legislation was now piled up behind it, including the 13 appropriation bills necessary to keep the government running. The House had passed 6 of those bills. The Senate had passed none. It is always true that Congress begins slowly and ends in a whirlwind, the New York Times said, but the beginnings this year have seemed even slower than usual. The tone of press coverage had changed, too. The civil rights bill is in serious trouble, the Washington Post said on April 28th. It has a fair chance of enactment in the House, but the once bright prospect of Senate enactment this session appears increasingly dim. When Clifford Case said that the tactics fatal to past civil rights bills were being repeated in 1957 and would have the same effect, Roscoe Drummond understood. Senator Case is quite right in warning that it is happening all over again this spring, the columnist wrote. Senator Johnson and Republican leader Senator William Noland have both said that they hoped to expedite action on the civil rights program so that the Senate would not have to debate it during the closing days of the session. That expediting is not yet visible. Some civil rights advocates still had hopes, although they were fading. There is need for a dramatic rescue if the civil rights bill is not to be smothered to death, Philip Graham's Washington Post editorialized. For others, hope was all but gone. Everything is waiting on something else, Senator Norris Cotton of New Hampshire said on April 27th. The Senate is waiting for the House. Aid for school construction is waiting on civil rights. Civil rights seems to be waiting for the millennium. And among those who had, seemingly, all but lost hope, was Lyndon Johnson. In early January, he had predicted that a civil rights bill would pass, but shortly afterwards he had begun pulling back from the fight. Those early optimistic predictions were not repeated, were replaced by silence. From January 19th to May 29th, Lyndon Johnson made not a single public statement on civil rights. And if, during these 4 months, his lack of words spoke loudly, so did his lack of actions. Not only was he not clearing the Senate decks for a filibuster fight, his behind-the-scenes efforts to find a compromise acceptable to both sides had become perfunctory. For a surprisingly large portion of this period, in fact, he wasn't behind the scenes, or even in Washington. During this 4-month period, he took a 9-day vacation in Florida and a 19-day vacation over Easter at his ranch. If one includes short trips, one to New York, one to Miami, several to Huntlands, he was away from Washington for some 42 days out of the 130 days in this period. During these trips, he was, as always, constantly on the telephone with his staff in Washington about Senate matters, but civil rights was not uppermost among them. There was a time there when you would have thought he had all but given up on civil rights, Reedy says. You could understand that. It looked hopeless. Congress's return from the Easter recess on April 30th brought only more of the same. The minutes of the first post-recess Republican legislative leaders' meeting at the White House report that it is expected that this legislation, civil rights, will reach the House floor in about 2 weeks. But somehow that happy event did not occur. May 14th, the importance of early action on this legislation was again stressed. May 21st. It is expected that this measure will be reported by the House Rules Committee and that the House will begin to discuss it within the next few days. At the first post-recess meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Hennings raised his hand, intending to introduce a motion setting a firm early date for a vote on the civil rights bill. But at the foot of the Democratic side of the committee table, another hand shot up, that of Senator Ervin. And it was Ervin whom Chairman Eastland recognized. Ervin launched into what was evidently going to be a long speech, and every time Hennings attempted to break in, Eastland would ask him not to interrupt another senator. In the halls of government, there was still no real leadership for the cause of social justice. The president was again ducking every chance to show any, resolutely avoiding every opportunity to press for action on his Attorney General's civil rights bill. Asked if he was satisfied with the progress on the bill, Eisenhower replied, "Progress in Congress is a very spotty thing." His party's congressional leaders, he said, had assured him that they were making their best effort to bring these bills up and get them passed. The House Rules Committee did indeed report the bill, H.R. 6127, out on May 22nd, so that a date to begin debate on the measure in the House could be set, but that action only began to increase attention on the Senate. And the Washington Post reported that Senate leaders weren't too optimistic. Noland forecast a lengthy debate which some might call a filibuster. "The South is still in control," Senator Alexander Wiley said. Attention was also beginning to focus on Lyndon Johnson. After his return from the ranch on April 28th, he tried to avoid public statements on the issue, as an exchange on the Senate floor on May 13th showed. Responding to White House criticism of senatorial inaction on Eisenhower's program, he listed the various bills that were shortly going to be brought to the floor, without mentioning the civil rights bill. Noland, standing across the aisle from him, twitted him on the omission. "I notice, perhaps by inadvertence, that my distinguished friend, the majority leader, had not mentioned the proposed civil rights legislation. We are now in the month of May. I was very hopeful that the distinguished majority leader might throw some light on the question as to when we could expect that proposed legislation on the floor." Johnson's angry reply, "Mr. President, my friend from California has asked me a question. I am not sure that he is really soliciting information," seemed to show a sympathy for the Southern view that the Supreme Court had already pushed civil rights as far as could be expected, and that the country should now be allowed a respite from further action. "It is the view of the senator from Texas," the senator from Texas said, "that the Supreme Court has acted in connection with the education and transportation problem, and that all over the land the American people are doing their best to adjust themselves to the situation created by the court's decision, and are attempting to evolve a workable solution in the light of that decision." His reply also showed irritation with those who were, nevertheless, still agitating for civil rights. "The majority leader," said the majority leader, "although he does not agree with all the proposals made, and indeed does not agree with many of them, realizes that a substantial number of members of both the House and Senate wish to vote on some so-called civil rights legislation, because to fail to do so would permit those who have no hesitancy in exploiting this political issue to continue to do so in the months ahead." His reply showed no sympathy for aggressive senatorial action on civil rights. To Noland's request for a date when we could expect that proposed legislation on the floor, Johnson's only response was that he would take no offense if, after the Judiciary Committee had acted or failed to act, Hennings or Noland himself should make a motion to discharge the committee. "If they did," Johnson said, "I believe this question will be acted upon. Some action will come by the early part of next month." Some action, not favorable action. And the action he was talking about was not action on a civil rights bill, but only action on a motion to put that bill on the Senate calendar, a motion that could be filibustered, as the bill, should it ever get to the floor, would be filibustered. When Johnson finished, Hennings rose at his desk and characterized his leader's statement. "The same old hocus-pocus and the same old claptrap and the same old backing and filling," he said. In the New York Times, reporter C.P. Tressel was gently sarcastic. Senator Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas, the majority leader, while letting everybody know that he was against the program, said that he would not be offended if Mr. Noland or Senator Hennings should force it to floor action. Tressel concluded that it does not appear that it will be passed by Congress at this session. And if dreams of social justice seemed once more all but dead, so too did Lyndon Johnson's dreams for himself. He knew that the realization of that goal at which he had been aiming all his life required him to produce on civil rights. Knew that if I failed to produce on this one, everything I had built up over the years would be completely undone. And yet producing on civil rights seemed as hopeless a task as ever. A strong, meaningful civil rights bill was moving, slowly but moving, through the House. But then it would come to the Senate, where, if there was any chance of its passing, it would be filibustered to death. there would be no Civil Rights Act, and no removal from Lyndon Johnson's image of the scent of magnolias fatal to his presidential hopes. It seemed that spring of 1957 as if there was scarcely a newspaper or magazine that didn't remind him of that harsh reality. In April, for example, there was an article in The Progressive, entitled "The Legend of Lyndon Johnson." It said that his contention that he stood midway between Thurmond and Douglas, between the Southerners and the Liberals, is far from being the whole truth. For while Johnson himself is not the type of Southerner whose opposition to civil rights stems from the sincere depths of bigotry, while early in his life he taught classes of Mexican Americans, and while his opposition to civil rights springs not from passion but from political calculation, that fact does not make him any less dangerous a foe of civil rights. Johnson never strays far from his real power base in the Senate, his fellow Southerners, the article said. In fact, many observers still consider him little more than a pliant instrument of Senator Russell. And its evaluation of Johnson as a majority leader was devastating. He knows everyone's value, and knows even better his price if he has one. He is not the leader of great causes, but the broker of little ones. That article was written by David C. Williams, editor of ADA World, the official publication of that body of crazies and red-hots. But on May 25th, newspapers around the country carried an Associated Press interview with Colonel Jake Arvey, not a crazy, or indeed a particularly ardent, civil libertarian, but one of the most pragmatic and most powerful northern political leaders, about possible 1960 Democratic presidential nominees, and he said party leaders throughout the North were very high on two candidates, Kennedy and Symington. He didn't mention Lyndon Johnson, but the reporter asked about him. Senator Johnson, Arvey replied, would be hampered by the question mark concerning his health and by his Texas origins. Northerners, Arvey said, would be fearful of his position on the segregation issue. Though Lyndon Johnson realized the situation, however, there seemed to be nothing he could do about it. Looking back on the situation years later, George Reedy would be struck by the seeming impossibility of negotiating any type of compromise. The prospect of any legislative action, he said, seemed more remote than a landing on the moon. But there had been earlier episodes in Lyndon Johnson's career in which his chances appeared hopeless. That first campaign for the House, that campaign for the Senate against the invincible Coke Stevenson, other episodes too. And always Lyndon Johnson had reacted, after spells of depression and despair, in the same way, with a refusal to give up hope, with a willingness to fight on, and to make in the fight an effort so intense that days meant nothing, nights meant nothing, weekdays, weekends, they meant nothing. With that implacable determination to triumph no matter what the cost that had made Ava Johnson Cox and Estelle Harbin say about Lyndon Johnson when he was young that he could not stand to lose, just could not stand it, that he had to win, had to. And that was how Lyndon Johnson reacted now. What crystallized his feelings is not known, but it occurred on the ranch. Not long after he had returned to Washington from that 3-week Easter vacation on the Pedernales, even while he was still making public statements that let everybody know that he was against a civil rights bill, a difference in his attitude was becoming apparent to those who saw him behind closed doors. Richard Bolling, who had come to hate Johnson, in part because he had felt he was really quite negative on civil rights, and who had watched Johnson grow very quiet during the early months of 1957, as he had grown very quiet during 1956, whenever civil rights came up behind the closed doors of Sam Rayburn's late afternoon Board of Education, now began to see a change in Lyndon Johnson, a change that began almost imperceptibly, but that, afternoon by afternoon, became more marked. That was on the House side of the Capitol. On the Senate side, there were indications, too. Something changed, Gerald Siegel would say, and after it did, he never had any hesitation at all. Chapter 37, The Working Up. For Lyndon Johnson, determination had to include belief. He understood that all his life. as is shown by the fact that as a boy, he was always repeating the salesman's remark that you've got to believe in what you're selling. And that decades later, in his retirement, he would say, "What convinces is conviction. You simply have to believe in the argument you are advancing. If you don't, you're as good as dead. The other person will sense that something isn't there." And Lyndon Johnson could make himself believe in an argument even if he had never believed in it before, even if he had believed in an opposite argument, and even if the argument did not accord with the facts. A devotee like Joseph Califano would write that Johnson would quickly come to believe what he was saying even if it was clearly not true. When Lyndon Johnson came to believe in something, moreover, he came to believe in it totally, with absolute conviction, regardless of previous beliefs, or of the facts in the matter, came to believe in it so absolutely that George Reedy says, "I believe that he acted out of pure motives, regardless of their origins. He had a remarkable capacity to convince himself that he held the principles he should hold at any given time, and there was something charming about the air of injured innocence with which he would treat anyone who brought forth evidence that he had held other views in the past. It was not an act. He had a fantastic capacity to persuade himself that the truth, which was convenient for the present, was the truth, and anything that conflicted with it was the prevarication of enemies. He literally willed what was in his mind to become reality." Califano, listening to Johnson tell a story which Califano knew was not true, and which Califano knew that Johnson himself knew, or at least had known at one time was not true, writes of the authentic increase in the president's conviction each time he recited it. The phrase used to describe the process by longtime Texas associates like Ed Clark, the revving up or the working up, was homier, but it was the same process. He could start talking about something and convince himself it was right and get all worked up and emotional, and work all day and all night and sacrifice and say, "Follow me for the cause. Let's do this because it's right." And, Clark says, Johnson would believe it was right, no matter what he had believed before. To pass civil rights legislation, to convince senators of the need for such legislation, Lyndon Johnson therefore had to believe totally, with absolute conviction, that there was an urgent need for that legislation. He had to know that it was right to fight for it. And knowing it coldly, intellectually, was not enough. He had to feel it wholeheartedly, to feel what the color of their skin meant to those Americans whose skin was darker than his. To fight wholeheartedly for justice for those people, he had to feel the injustice that had been visited upon them and that was still being visited upon them. He had to make himself feel their fears and their doubts, had to make himself feel all the injustices and indignities that America had inflicted on them, from the lash and the leg irons all the way down through the decades, the generations, to the word colored above the drinking fountains. So now began the working up. Sometimes the working up was couched in terms of pragmatism. In the homes of longtime conservative, somewhat racist friends, the phone would ring now, often long after midnight, and on the phone would be Lyndon Johnson. "I can't sleep," he would say, and he would begin talking, to convince himself as well as them. One of the friends was his protege, Joe M. Kilgore. When Johnson told the young Texas congressman one night in 1957 that a civil rights bill should be passed, Kilgore resisted the suggestion. "The problem with you is that you don't understand that the world is trying to turn to the left," Lyndon Johnson said vehemently. "You can either get out in front and try to give some guidance, or you can continue to fight upstream and be overwhelmed or be miserable." The congressman had known Lyndon Johnson for a long time, had traveled the valley with him in 1941 and 1948. And he says he understood the purpose of the phone call and of Johnson's words. "He was talking like he was giving me advice, but it was really himself he was giving the advice to. He wasn't talking to convince me, he was talking to convince himself." And sometimes the working up was couched in very different terms. At dinner parties in the homes of liberal friends, Lyndon Johnson began to tell again the stories with which, during his early years in Washington, he had won Alice Glass's heart and the hearts of the young New Dealers close to FDR, but which he had been telling less frequently in the years since he had come to the Senate. In the summer of 1957, there was a small dinner party in the Georgetown house of Daz and Richard Harkness. And one of the eight people at the table was Frank Church's wife, Bethine. I remember at this dinner party, Johnson talking about teaching the Mexican-American kids in Catulla, and his frustration that they had no books, Bethine Church recalls. I remember it as one of the most passionate evenings I've ever spent. He had a new story, too, about a talk he had had some years before, probably about 1951, with Gene Williams, the husband of the Johnson's maid, Helen Williams. At the end of each congressional session, the Johnson's car was driven back to Austin from Washington by Gene and Helen, and the Johnson's third African-American employee, their cook, Zephyr Wright, while the Johnsons flew back in the Brown and Root plane. Then, when Congress reconvened in January, Ms. Wright and the Williamses drove the car back to Washington. During Johnson's talk with Gene Williams, Johnson asked him to take along the Johnson's dog, Little Beagle Johnson. Williams hesitated and then asked, "Senator, do we have to take Beagle?" Johnson asked, "Tell me what's the matter. Why don't you want to take Beagle? What aren't you telling me?" When Williams still hesitated, Johnson said, "Gene, I want an answer." "Well, Senator," Gene finally replied, "it's tough enough to get all the way from Washington to Texas. We drive for hours and hours. We get hungry. But there's no place on the road we can stop and go in and eat. We drive some more. It gets pretty hot. We want to wash up. But the only bathroom we're allowed in is usually miles off the main highway. We keep going till night comes, till we get so tired we can't stay awake anymore. We're ready to pull in. But it takes another hour or so to find a place to sleep. You see, what I'm saying is that a colored man's got enough trouble getting across the South on his own without having a dog along." In the memoirs he published during his retirement, Lyndon Johnson was to write that that discussion had been an awakening for him, because he realized there was absolutely nothing I could say to Gene Williams or to any black man or to myself. That while, of course, he had known that such discrimination existed throughout the South, somehow we had deluded ourselves into believing that black people around us were happy and satisfied, into thinking that the bad and ugly things were going on somewhere else, happening to other people, that the day of the discussion had been the day I first realized the sad truth, that to the extent Negroes were imprisoned, so was I. If Johnson actually experienced such an epiphany on that day, however, it was an experience he kept to himself for quite some time. His three employees were excused from taking the dog. Little Beagle continued to fly back and forth to Texas with the Johnsons, but not from taking the car, year after year, twice a year, on that three-day drive across 1,300 miles of the South. In 1953, Zephyr simply refused to keep making the trip. "I just wouldn't go," she recalls. But Gene and Helen Williams went on making it every year. And while many associates and acquaintances of Lyndon Johnson, interviewed by the author, recall Johnson recounting the story of his talk with Gene Williams, if he told the story for some years after the conversation occurred, he didn't tell it often. When the author asked these people when Johnson began telling it, none of them could give a precise answer. But asked to make an estimate, every one of them who was willing to do so replied with some version of the phrase, "about the time he began fighting for civil rights." Now, however, in 1957, the story became a staple of his conversation at Georgetown dinner tables, and in other venues as well. He told it over and over, with his customary vividness. Harry McPherson, who overheard the story in 1963 when Johnson was telling it to John Stennis, describes the occasion, in doing so showing Johnson's storytelling gift at work. "You know, John," Lyndon Johnson said, "the other day a sad thing happened. My cook, Zephyr Wright, who has been working for me for many years, she's a college graduate, and her husband drove my official car from Washington down to Texas, the Cadillac limousine of the Vice President of the United States. They drove through your state, and when they got hungry, they stopped at grocery stores on the edge of town in colored areas and bought Vienna sausages and beans and ate them with a plastic spoon. And when they had to go to the bathroom, they would stop, pull off on a side road, and Zephyr Wright, the cook of the Vice President of the United States, would squat in the road to pee. And you know, John, that's just bad. That's wrong." and as Lyndon Johnson told it, he felt it. He may not have been moved by the story, at least not moved enough to tell it and not moved enough to excuse his three employees from the car transport assignment, during the intervening years since he had first heard it. But he was certainly moved by it in 1957. He not only had the gift of reading men and women, of seeing into their hearts, he also had the gift of putting himself in their place, of not just seeing what they felt, but of feeling what they felt, almost as if what had happened to them had happened to him too. He may not have understood the feelings of Ms. Wright and the Williamses before, but he understood, had made himself understand, had willed himself to understand, those feelings now. The hurt Gene Williams felt when a hotel clerk turned him away wasn't only Gene Williams's hurt now, it was Lyndon Johnson's too. He felt the hurt, and he felt for the people who had been hurt, felt the injustice and humiliation that had been visited upon them, grew angry for them, with an anger that was passionate and real. John, that's just bad. That's wrong. And when Stennis tried to say, "Well, Lyndon, I'm sure there are nice places where you're cook," and Johnson, according to McPherson, just said, uh-huh, and just sort of looked away vacantly and said, "Well, thank you, John." And after the Mississippi senator walked away, Johnson turned around to me and winked, as if to say, "What can you expect?" And McPherson felt that that was straight from real feelings. That made him angry. The simple indignity of discrimination was deep in Johnson. The indignities that Ms. Wright and the Williamses had suffered made him angry, sometimes just about to tears, Califano says. Lyndon Johnson had, at last, put himself in their place as much as any white person could do so, which meant he had, as much as any white person could do so, put himself in the place of all the people of America on whom indignities and injustice were visited because their skins were not white. The empathy and compassion for black Americans had always been there inside Lyndon Johnson, but it had always been held in check. Now it was unleashed. Lyndon Johnson believed in the need for a civil rights bill now, believed with that intensity which, in other crises in his career, had led him to take the all-or-nothing gamble, to shove in his whole stack, to determine, no matter how long the odds, to win. When Lyndon Johnson was this worked up, when he was as determined as he was upon returning to Washington from the ranch after Easter, beside that determination all other considerations paled. A civil rights bill had to be passed, and a civil rights bill was going to be passed. And shortly after his return to Washington, he said so, to the surprise of a friendly journalist, Tris Coffin, with whom he was having an off-the-record breakfast in the Senate dining room. "A civil rights bill is going to be passed by this Congress," Lyndon Johnson said. His tone was thoughtful, but suddenly he raised his big hand and smacked it down on his thigh to punctuate the words. "I'd like to see a bill the country can live with and not get torn apart," he said. "I don't know the answer, but I'm going to do a lot of listening." During the late spring and early summer months of 1957, Booth Mooney would write, Lyndon Johnson began to go tirelessly from faction to faction, working quietly, almost in secret, refraining from making any public statement of his intentions. He was asking, probing, buttonholing senators and staff, lobbyists and lawyers in the corridors of the Capitol and the SOB, sitting down beside a senator on one of the cloakroom couches and chatting in a relaxed manner, and then, suddenly, his eyes narrowing at some words that had caught his attention, words that had been spoken or words that hadn't been spoken, taking the senator's arm and asking him to step outside into the corridor for a moment for a more private conversation, dropping in on senators in their inner offices, closing the door behind him, listening to what they were saying, and listening to what they weren't saying. And out of the buttonholing and the asking and the listening, Lyndon Johnson was beginning to form a strategy. For as he listened, he heard something. The most important thing a man tells you is what he's not telling you. Talking to the Southern senators, Lyndon Johnson was listening to a lot of furious tirades about the Brownell bill. If one didn't listen closely, all of the bill's provisions appeared equally abhorrent to them. But Johnson, listening very closely, realized that one provision was not being mentioned nearly so much as the others. Sometimes, in fact, it was not mentioned at all, and when it was mentioned, While it was assailed just as harshly as the other provisions, Johnson was hearing, beneath the words, a somewhat different undertone. The provision was not in Part 3, the section of the bill that had been occupying most of both sides' attention, and most of Lyndon Johnson's attention, since January, and on which both sides held positions so intractable that compromise seemed impossible. The provision was Part 4, which dealt not with ending segregation on many fronts, but instead with a single right, the right to vote. When Southern senators talked about the clauses in Part 3 that would force employers to hire blacks, or that would allow blacks to sit next to whites in classrooms or movie theaters, they poured out their anger harshly, uncompromisingly. But when the right to vote came up, the tone of voice was different, less defiant, sometimes, in fact, almost ashamed. It was fascinating for me, a Yankee who might be able to comprehend but could not share Southern feelings, to hear him talk, Reedy recalls. Most Southerners, he said, were not very concerned about depriving blacks of decent jobs. They had hypnotized themselves into a belief that Negroes were inherently unwilling to accept heavy responsibilities, and were much more at ease doing menial tasks which did not require them to make decisions. As for segregation, Dixie theoreticians had created a whole mythology about people being happier with their own kind. None of those attitudes were going to change in the near future, in LBJ's estimate, and it was futile to anticipate any give on these points. There was one area, however, in which he contended that Southern consciences were hurting. This was in the field of voting rights. Here, he claimed, even the most outspoken of white supremacists had a sense of doing something wrong. Partly this was because many of the Southern senators believed, if not always in the spirit, but in the literal words of the Constitution, which was explicit on the question of suffrage, saying as it did that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged on account of race or color. They were constitutionalists, even though they were quite willing to concoct some peculiar interpretations of the document, Reedy was to say. The amended Constitution, however much they despised the amendments, did guarantee blacks the right to vote. It did not say anything about the right to a job, or the right to social equality, or even the right to decent treatment by society. On voting, however, it was unequivocal. Even Harry Byrd sometimes murmured something about a basic constitutional right when the subject of voting came up. Even Thurmond, who had said, "I will never favor mixing of the races," didn't use the word never when that subject came up. The Southern senators insisted that they were opposed to every aspect of the Civil Rights Bill, but listening to them closely, Johnson had come to feel that to one aspect of it they might be less opposed than to the others. While the South would not accept a Part 3 with or without a jury trial amendment, he realized, they might accept Part 4 with a jury trial amendment. This price still seemed impossibly high. Liberals would never agree to a jury trial amendment for any part of the bill. But Lyndon Johnson realized there was a Southern price, where there had never been a price before. The Southerners' feelings were not new. They had almost certainly been expressed to Lyndon Johnson before, during the previous months of discussion of the bill. But they had been obscured during these months by the emphasis on Part 3, and they had become obscured as well by the Southerners' insistence that any provisions in the bill be covered by a jury trial amendment. No one had focused on the voting right because of the overwhelming belief among liberals that no matter what rights were covered by the bill, that coverage would be meaningless if Southern violators were tried by Southern juries. But now Lyndon Johnson was focusing on Part 4, and he saw the potential in the Southern attitude toward that part. The South was not insisting, as it had invariably insisted in the past, that it would not accept any civil rights bill, that it would, by filibustering, prevent any civil rights bill from coming to the Senate floor and to a Senate vote. If he was somehow able to get Part 3 out of the bill, to get the 1957 Civil Rights Act limited to a single right, voting, and to guarantee jury trials to defendants in voting rights cases, the act would be very weak, but it was possible that the South, while not, of course, actually voting for it, would not filibuster it, that the South would allow a civil rights bill to come to the Senate floor for the first time in 82 years, and then to be voted on there. This vulnerable spot in the South's position was, furthermore, in the very place he had hoped to find it. for Lyndon Johnson's talents as a legislator went far beyond those of mere listening. He had the great lawmaker's gift of identifying, amid a panorama of many proposed laws, the one that would best accomplish a larger purpose. And he saw now that if he could get only one provision of the Civil Rights Bill enacted, voting was the one it should be. Of all the rights that black Americans had so long been denied, the right to vote was the one which, if he could get it for them, would be most valuable. For the granting of that right would, he knew, lead, perhaps slowly but inevitably, to all the others. His reasoning sprang from his understanding of and belief in power. The way to end the indignities Negroes had to suffer was to give them the power to end them, and in a democracy, power comes from the ballot box. Give Negroes the vote, give them power, and they could start doing the rest for themselves. The liberals wanted to change so many laws, housing laws, transportation laws, public accommodations laws, private accommodations laws, school desegregation laws, all those laws that were covered in Part 3 of the Brownell Bill. The Southern senators would never agree that these laws should be changed, and the Southern senators had enough power to ensure that they would not be changed. Therefore, Lyndon Johnson saw, don't try to change the laws, just change the officials who wrote the laws. Then they would change the laws. And the way to change the officials was to give Southern Negroes the right to vote, so that officials who wanted to be elected would have to be solicitous of Negroes' other rights. Those who weren't sufficiently solicitous could be voted out of office. Negro voters could vote them out. Giving black Americans the vote would, moreover, change not only the laws but the administration of laws. The urgency for laws to restrain the brutality of small-town Southern sheriffs would be alleviated, for example, since in many a Southern small town, blacks had enough votes to elect the sheriff they wanted. Lyndon Johnson started trying to explain this to liberals. Just give Negroes the vote and many of these problems will get better, he told James Reston. Give them, the Negroes, the vote, and in a few years they, the Southern senators, will be kissing their ass, he told Hubert Humphrey. If out of all the civil rights that would be guaranteed by the Brownell Bill, only one could pass, he knew which right it should be, and it was the very one that the Southerners, not seeing what he saw, were willing to let pass. Lyndon Johnson's purpose was no longer merely to help himself. Now he was trying to lift up a whole people, a nation within a nation. And he knew what to do for these people. He had made himself one of them. He knew something else, too, that the most important thing wasn't what was in the bill. The most important thing was that there be a bill. One of the reasons for this was psychological. The South had won in the Senate so many times that there existed in the Senate a conviction that the South could not be beaten, particularly on the cause that meant the most to it. A number of senators, not the most ardent liberals, but a few others, intimidated already by the Southerners' power over their bills and their committee assignments, were further intimidated by this conviction. What was the point of challenging the South, risking so much, when in the end the South was bound to win? You felt this around the Senate, Jim Rowe was to say. There was a mystique about them, the Southern senators. God, don't get the South mad. And why get them mad when you weren't going to win anyway? With Westerners or Midwesterners who didn't care too much about civil rights anyway, this was a big consideration. A victory over the South would begin destroying this mystique, demonstrate that the South could be beaten and more attempts would be made to beat it. Johnson saw this, as Rowan Corcoran and Reedy and others close to him in 1957 attest. He used a typically earthy phrase to explain it. Once you break the virginity, he said, it'll be easier next time. Pass one civil rights bill, no matter how weak, and others would follow. And there was a further reason, Lyndon Johnson saw, why the passage of any civil rights bill, no matter how weak, would be a crucial gain for civil rights. Once a bill was passed, it could later be amended. Altering something was a lot easier than creating it. Aware though he became after his return to Washington following the 1957 Easter recess that his only slim hope of passing a civil rights bill would be to amend it down into a very weak bill, Johnson nonetheless realized that, however insignificant the bill's provisions, passage of the measure would be deeply significant, not only for his personal dreams, but for the dreams of the 16 million American citizens whose skins were black. Chapter 38. Hell's Canyon. The price that Lyndon Johnson now realized the South would accept to allow a civil rights bill to pass, that the bill be restricted to voting and include a jury trial amendment, seemed a price simply too high for him to meet. Most of the 27 non-Southern Democratic senators and the overwhelming majority of the 46 Republicans, Joe McCarthy died on May 2nd, leaving his seat vacant until a special election was held on August 28th, were opposed to both these conditions. The South, with its 22 Senate votes, is completely without allies, George Reedy wrote in a memo to Johnson in the spring of 1957, and he was exaggerating only slightly. When, in late spring, Johnson embarked on his quest for a civil rights bill, there was available, should the South's two conditions come to a showdown, no place to find enough votes to meet them. And since the South would lose on a vote, it would simply not allow one. It would filibuster. And though they had no allies on civil rights, on a filibuster the situation would be far different. On a cloture vote, you got up to 33 real fast. There could be filibusters at any one or all of several points. Since killing the bill was so important to the South, Richard Russell would not want to risk everything on a single cloture vote, and would begin filibustering at the earliest point, the vote to put the bill on the calendar. The measure would be kept bottled up in the Judiciary Committee as long as possible, and if a motion was finally made on the Senate floor to discharge it from Judiciary and place it on the calendar, the South would filibuster that motion, beginning debate on it and then extending the debate and continuing to extend it, for as long as was necessary to block the motion from coming to a vote. And if that filibuster was cut off by cloture, the South could filibuster again to prevent the bill from being called off the calendar and brought to the floor for debate and vote. And if that filibuster failed, too, could filibuster yet again to prevent that final floor vote. The South would also, of course, filibuster a motion to place a House-passed civil rights bill directly on the calendar without it being sent to Judiciary. For Lyndon Johnson to pass the bill, he had to find allies for the South, votes for its positions on Part 3 and jury trials, as well as the assurance of votes against cloture in case it lost on those points. And with the session already deep in May, he had to find those votes almost immediately. Only if the South felt confident that the votes would be there if they were needed, would it allow the bill to reach the calendar. Johnson had to let the South know that it was not alone, that it had allies in the Senate. He had, in addition, to let the South know that it had enough allies. The bill was too important for Russell to risk everything on a vote in which the margin would be so narrow that it might be changed at the last moment. A handful or two handfuls of promised votes would not make the South feel confident that an unacceptable bill could not pass, confident enough so that it could allow the measure to reach the calendar. Lyndon Johnson had to find not merely a few votes, but a whole group of votes, a large, solid Senate bloc. In May 1957, with Republicans and liberal Democrats lined up solidly behind a civil rights bill, with the necessity for a bill dramatized by the struggles in the South, and with the press and public demand for a bill rising, the formation of such a bloc seemed outside the realm of possibility. Determined though Johnson might be, determination couldn't create that bloc. Listening couldn't create it. This problem was so dramatically intractable that something more was needed. Not only legislative leadership, but legislative genius. Recruiting an entire bloc of allies for the South would require an ability to conceive and then create not merely individual deals, simple quid pro quos, and not merely a series of interrelated deals, complicated though that in itself could be, but a single, much broader deal, a deal broad enough to bring an entire group of senators to the side of the South in one stroke. A quid pro quo of a magnitude so sweeping as to be truly national in scope. Lyndon Johnson found that deal, found a bloc, and found a means of bringing it to the South's side. The means was a mountain canyon, a canyon not in the South but more than 2,000 miles away, beyond the Appalachians, beyond the Mississippi Basin, beyond the Great Plains, beyond the Rocky Mountains. In the rugged Sawtooth Mountains that rose beyond the Rockies in America's far northwest. Hell's Canyon, it had been given its name by pioneering mountain men whose boats had been capsized by its foaming white rapids, was an astonishing work of nature. Carved into one of the most inaccessible parts of the Sawtooth Range by the Snake River, its rock walls rose from the snake's turbulent waters in a widening V that was almost 8,000 feet high, 1,000 feet higher than the Grand Canyon. It was the deepest river gorge on the continent of North America, and it had been the subject for some years of a debate over who would harness the enormous power generated by its turbulent waters, the public, through a dam built by the federal government, or a private power company. That question had become in some ways the hottest political issue in Oregon and Idaho, the two states separated by the snake. For 10 years, public power advocates, including both of Oregon's current senators, Wayne Morse and Richard Neuberger, had been trying to obtain authorization to build a federal dam, and for 10 years these attempts had been blocked by private power advocates in Congress. And then hardly had the Eisenhower administration taken office in 1953 when its Secretary of the Interior, Douglas McKay, a former governor of Oregon, announced that legislation would be introduced to allow the Idaho Power Company to build 3 hydroelectric dams in Hell's Canyon and sell the electricity they generated. The full extent of this giveaway of national resources became known when it was revealed that the administration had granted Idaho Power an accelerated tax write-off that would generate $239 million in additional profits. But to Republicans, including President Eisenhower, the idea of using taxpayers' money to build a project that private capital was willing to finance was a perfect example of New Deal profligacy. Assailing the administration's shocking abandonment of the public power concept, Morse reintroduced his proposed authorization of a federal dam. But when the showdown over his bill came in 1956, Republican senators reported, as Marquis Childs wrote, that they had never before, during the Eisenhower administration, been under such pressure, and the bill had been defeated. That defeat, however, made the issue hotter than ever. The governors of Oregon and Idaho, supporters of Idaho Power, ran for re-election in 1956 and both lost. In that year, furthermore, McKay returned to Oregon to run against Morse, calling the issue American free enterprise against the left-wing socialist idea. McKay was routed. Across the snake in Idaho, there was another Senate campaign, with Herman Welker, a private power advocate, running for re-election against Frank Church. The campaign was Frank Church versus Idaho Power, one of Church's aides says. They fought him tooth and nail. Welker lost, too. Since Morse and Neuberger and Church had made Hell's Canyon their central campaign issue, their constituents would be watching to see if they produced on it. And the senators wanted to produce on it. All 3 believed deeply in the concept of public power. The Hell's Canyon fight had reverberations in other states, in the far northwest and southward down the long line of the Rockies, for these states were tied together physically by the transmission lines from huge federal dams already built. The lines from the Bonneville Dam on the Oregon-Washington border, for example, ran not only across these states but into Idaho and Montana as well, and philosophically by the concept symbolized by these lines, that America's rivers belonged to the people, and the electricity they generated should be provided to the people at the lowest possible cost. Hydroelectric power generated in these states by the fall of the waters of their rivers down through their tall mountains was the region's greatest natural resource. And in 9 states, the 7 so-called mountain states, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Nevada, and the far northwest states of Washington and Oregon, whose mountains were not the Rockies but the Cascades, the question of how to get water, scarce in those states, and the power that water can generate, out of the rugged mountain ranges to irrigate millions of acres, mechanize tens of thousands of farms, and furnish inexpensive electricity to attract new industry, was a fiercely contentious issue. The debate between those who wanted the rivers developed by the federal government in order to keep rates down, preserve natural resources and beauty, and encourage the comprehensive development of river basins, and those who hated the concept of public power because they believed it led to socialism, bureaucracy, and a planned economy, and to lower profits for private utilities, was a continuing focal point of politics in these states, and in the Senate. Morse's speeches on behalf of a Hell's Canyon dam had been notable, but no more notable than those of Washington State's Scoop Jackson. And that state's other senator, Warren Magnuson, while no great speechmaker, had used his Commerce Committee gavel effectively in the dam's behalf. Morse, Neuberger, Jackson, Magnuson, New Mexico's Anderson, Montana's Murray, all were members of a Western public power bloc in the Senate. In all, there were, from these 9 Western states, a total of 12 Democratic senators who wanted the dam in Hell's Canyon to be a federal dam. Despite years of effort, however, the public power bloc had not been able to get that dam authorized. The private power forces in the Senate were, as Leland Olds had learned years earlier, very strong. Olds had the lesson taught to him again in 1955, after he had testified for 2 days on behalf of the Hell's Canyon Dam. A Federal Power Commission examiner called his testimony irrelevant and had every word of it stricken from the record except for 2 items, his name and address. During the 1956 battle over Morse's Hell's Canyon Dam bill, Republicans had made the necessary arrangements. Welker had secretly approached Louisiana's Russell Long, for example, and pledged to support the Tidelands oil legislation Long wanted if Long would vote against Hell's Canyon in the Interior Committee. Long had agreed, and Morse's bill had died in Interior. Now, in 1957, Morse and Neuberger were again trying, with assistance from Church, to persuade Interior to report the bill out, but they weren't succeeding. The Western senators simply didn't have enough allies on public power, as the South didn't have enough allies on civil rights. Lyndon Johnson saw a potential connection between those two realities. No one else had seen it. During the 10 years that Hell's Canyon had been before Congress, there had never been the slightest link between the dam and civil rights. The civil rights issue had never aroused much interest in those Western states, in part because so few of their residents would be directly affected by it. More than 500,000 people lived in Montana in 1956. About 1,000 of them were Negroes. Another 500,000 lived in Idaho. About 1,000 of them were Negroes. The total Negro population of the 9 states was about 79,000, fewer Negroes than lived in some counties in Georgia or Mississippi, fewer than lived in the single congressional district that was New York's Harlem. But now, Lyndon Johnson saw that not only could the dam authorization bill be brought into a relationship with the civil rights bill, but that that relationship could be the key to passing a civil rights bill. The very paucity of Negroes in the Western states was a key to his reasoning. Although many of the 12 Democratic senators from these states were liberals, civil rights was not a high-priority issue to their constituents, so these senators had flexibility on a civil rights bill. They could support it or not with impunity. Hell's Canyon, on the other hand, was a high-priority issue. Years later, talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin, Johnson would explain his reasoning with his customary hyperbole and his customary brilliance. "I began with the assumption that most of the senators from the mountain states had never seen a Negro and simply couldn't care all that much about the whole civil rights issue," he told her. "I knew what they did care about, and that was the Hell's Canyon issue. So I went to a few key Southerners and persuaded them to back the Western liberals on Hell's Canyon." "Tidelands wasn't the most important issue this year," he told Russell Long. "There was more at stake now." Long understood the oblique phrase, and besides, the Louisiana senator was to recall years later, "with Herman Welker out, it was a whole new ball game." With the deal he had made with Welker now void, "it was not a matter of great consequence to me whether you built a high, federal, dam at Hell's Canyon or a low, private dam at Hell's Canyon. What mattered was that civil rights bill, the jury trial amendment, for example, and Lyndon managed to work it out in such a fashion that some of the Western senators would go along with us on the jury trial problem if we'd go along with them on the Hell's Canyon issue." Long was happy to go along. With Southern gentlemen like Long, the matter was handled in a gentlemanly fashion. Putting his arm around one of these Southerners in the cloakroom, Johnson would say, "Look, if you don't help them, the Western senators, you can't expect them to help you when it's your ox that's getting gored." In other cases, the transaction was more straightforward. Montana's Jim Murray approached Jim Eastland to solicit his vote for the dam. "I need help on Hell's Canyon," he said. Eastland's reply was blunt. I need help on civil rights, he said. He told Murray to see Dick Russell, and Russell told the elderly Montana liberal, in a statement seconded by Johnson, that Southern votes would be available for Hell's Canyon if the Westerners were prepared to be reasonable on civil rights. And with other Southerners, the transaction was blunter still. Some of the Southern conservatives felt so strongly about the socialism symbolized by the proposed dam that they responded to Johnson's overtures by saying they couldn't vote for it. Johnson spelled out for these senators a reality they had overlooked. Senate authorization of a federal dam wouldn't really mean that a dam would be built, he said. House authorization and presidential signature would still be required, and neither requirement was likely to be met. Johnson may even have guaranteed some Southerners that those requirements would not be met. At least one administrative assistant says that Johnson let it be known that the House Interior Committee was not going to let the Hell's Canyon bill come to the House floor. One way or another, Johnson persuaded the Southern senators to place at his disposal as many votes as would be needed to pass the Senate bill authorizing a federal dam in Hell's Canyon. In a particularly shrewd gesture, Richard Russell agreed that he would be one of those senators, although in previous years he had opposed such authorization. That gesture would be so plain that even the densest Westerner would be able to understand it. Russell was the South. The Westerners would know that if he was with them, the South would be with them, with as many votes as were necessary. Then Johnson let the Westerners know what he had done and why, assuring them that they would have the backing of the South. And in return, he was to tell Doris Kearns Goodwin, I got the Western liberals to back the Southerners on civil rights. Since the Westerners were liberals and proud of their liberal image, they were not eager to have it known that they had traded away their support for a strong civil rights bill. They let the final arrangement be confirmed through an aide, Morse's trusted assistant Merton C. Bernstein, a young labor lawyer. Shortly before Morse's bill authorizing the high dam was to come to the floor, the confirmation had not yet taken place, and the Western senators were unsure if they would really have the Southern votes. A luncheon was therefore arranged in Bobby Baker's office, one flight up in the Capitol, at which Johnson would be present, along with a group of Western senators and Bernstein. During the lunch, Bernstein recalls, Lyndon Johnson didn't put a bite of food in his mouth. He never stopped talking. But not about Hell's Canyon, not a word. After the senators had finished dessert, Morse said, Well, Mert, you know where everybody stands, and walked out, as did the other senators. I was left there with Lyndon Johnson, Bernstein recalls. And then, with the Westerners not there to hear the sordid details, Johnson went down the whole list of senators who could be persuaded to do something helpful. He undertook to get those who he could, and he made clear he could get enough. Now, Smathers is a private utility man, Bernstein recalls Johnson saying. But I think I can bring him along. The Westerners could stop worrying about Russell Long. Leave him to me, Johnson said. I can get Russell Long. They could stop worrying about Allen Bible, he said. Bible will do whatever I tell him to do. As for Harry Byrd, Johnson said, Now, Harry Byrd is a man of principle. I can't ask Harry Byrd to do anything against his principles. But I can ask Harry Byrd, and he might oblige me to stay away during the vote on the Hell's Canyon Dam, and not vote against it. Bernstein understood what Johnson was doing. The majority leader was letting him know, and through him, Morse and the other Western senators, that he was working hard to get the votes for us because he wanted Western votes in return. Johnson was sealing the deal. Bernstein reported the conversation to Morse, and at Morse's instructions to the other Western senators, and they also understood what Johnson was doing, and the price he wanted in return. We knew that Johnson was not being a Boy Scout. We knew that he was trying to build a coalition against the parts of the Civil Rights Bill to which the Southerners were objecting. The Westerners agreed to pay that price. Lyndon Johnson, Russell Long was to say, put together sort of a gentleman's agreement where about four of us would vote for the high dam at Hell's Canyon, and about four of the fellows on the other side would vote with us. Four votes shifted in favor of that high dam at Hell's Canyon, and then four votes shifted, or at least came down on, a completely unrelated subject, civil rights. Long's memory is a little blurry as to the precise figure. The number of votes that actually shifted on that first ballot was not 4, but 5. And the number of Western Liberal Democratic votes that, as a result of the Hell's Canyon deal, would shift to the side of the South on later civil rights ballots would vary from ballot to ballot. Nor is the exact number of votes that shifted an accurate indication of the dimensions of the deal. Since the Southerners would not want to be seen voting for the Hell's Canyon Dam, Johnson would use as few of them as possible on the Hell's Canyon vote. Since the liberal Westerners would not want to be seen voting against civil rights, Johnson would use as few of them as possible on the civil rights vote. On each civil rights vote, he would use the minimum number of Westerners necessary to accomplish his purposes, not requiring the others to vote with the South. But the fundamental nature of the deal is what Johnson said it was. In return for Southern votes for Hell's Canyon, I got the Western liberals to back the Southerners on civil rights. While from vote to vote the number of Westerners would vary, whatever the number needed, the number would be there. It would be there on Part 3 and on the jury trial amendment. And the South could be confident that, if it was needed, it would be there on cloture as well. And the total number of these Westerners, the number that might, if necessary, be available to the South, was 12. In a single stroke, by linking Hell's Canyon and civil rights, Lyndon Johnson had brought to the side of the South not just a few senators, but a substantial block. And the South, therefore, was now willing to allow a civil rights bill to be placed on the calendar. Its senators would still vote against the motion to put it on the calendar, of course, so that they could tell their constituents they had opposed the motion, but they would forego the filibuster that would, by preventing the motion from coming to a vote, have made their opposition effective. The South had previously been adamant in its opposition to allowing the bill to go on the calendar. Isolated, without allies, it had felt itself defenseless against a strong civil rights bill except for the filibuster, and therefore had not been willing to forego any of